Hey, you're listening to The Close Up. Please be warned, this podcast has spoilers and gross, gross, foul, disgusting language, but not very much, but a little bit. Hey, welcome to The Close Up on the Overthink Podcast Network. My name is James Roland.
And this is David Veloz.
And this is the show where we take a close-up look at a film director's body of work. And rather than just talk in a big overview about it, we try and zoom in on particular parts that might hold a key to both techniques that that film director uses, but then also what themes and what things they might be trying to say throughout the course of their career.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And today we are going to talk about the Safdie brothers, which I think is how you pronounce it, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, it's either Safdie or Safdie. I tried looking it up. I couldn't find it.
Couldn't find it either. Okay, so forgive us. But and the reason why we've been talking about doing this podcast for a bit, and we were originally going to do Sam Mendes.
Yeah.
Which we will do later. But then we saw Good Time, which is incredible. If you haven't seen it, go see it. I think it's still in theaters. It'll hit streaming soon, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to admit that that was the first time I'd ever heard of these guys. Had you heard about them before?
I'd not heard about them at all. I'm sure that they have a bit more of a cult following in the indie world. I'm sure they've got a name for themselves in the film festival sector. But they, you know, having Robert Pattinson in this film that just came out is shooting them into the limelight. So yeah. Now everybody knows who they are, including us.
Do you know how they got him involved in their new movie?
No, I don't actually.
So there's, you know, that image from the movie they did last time, the movie right before this has that cool image of the blonde girl.
Oh, and Heaven Knows
out.
What?
Yeah, Heaven Knows with the weird colors and like the deep purple and red.
Yeah.
And he got obsessed with her.
Yeah, the one that is almost. The frame, it's a close-up of the female protagonist's face.
Yeah.
And the frame is basically split in half with two shades of color. One's like an indigo blue, and the other is like a hot pink. And it's
a great picture.
Yeah, it's one of those things you can't even put words to. It's just you look at it, and it grabs you.
And he got obsessed with it and reached out to them. And then they started. Yeah, I know, right? Which is such a ridiculous kind of like cliched Hollywood actory kind of.
You know, you say that though.
But it's amazing.
I get it. I actually understand it. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's that's all I knew. Yeah, and when I saw that image when I researched this, I recognized the poster or the DVD cover for that movie. But that's the only thing I knew about these guys. And so I kind of went in not blind, but I saw the trailer that A24 did for Good Time, and their trailers are amazing.
Yeah, you sent it to me.
And saw it, and then was obsessed with it and drug you to it.
Yeah.
And
you saw it first.
So what wowed me about the movie was the sheer amount of craft on display in it. It's for those of you that don't know, it's a thriller about two brothers, one who is mentally challenged, the other one who's a fast, smooth-talking criminal played by Robert Pattinson. And his brother with the mental problems is Benny Safdie, I believe. I believe it's Benny, not Josh.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the directors plays
it's Benny.
It.
Yeah, it's Benny.
And for all the buzz you're hearing about Robert Pattinson, there should be as much buzz about Benny's performance as well. It's out of this world.
Yeah.
And it's one of those starts simple and escalates into complexity. So he takes his brother and they hold up a bank. And one thing leads to another. The younger brother who with the mental problems is incarcerated, and the older brother wants to get him out. And it takes place over the course of a single night as he attempts to secure the bail money to get his brother out.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those, it gets worse and worse, and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper into this complicated night of different sorts of crimes, every type of crime imaginable.
Yeah, yeah. Like, basically, he starts off just trying to make up the little bit of money he needs, and when that goes awry, every single step of the way he tries to make up for the debacle that preceded him, he ends up in a crazier scenario where the stakes are higher, he's in more danger, and continues to place himself at risk.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, he never gives up.
Yeah. And it's one of those films where about every 10 minutes, something happens that was the last thing that you expected to happen.
Yes.
But not in a way that's like aliens or lasers or something just non sequitur. It's one of those things that happens where you're shocked and then you go, of course that happened.
Exactly.
It's brilliant. So it has a dramatic resonance to all of these finely tuned plot turns and surprises and twists. And it builds. We'll go back and talk in more detail about certain sections of this film that work. If you, I would recommend pausing this and actually watching the movie before you listen further. Just because it's,
we're gonna
it's
have
one thing
some,
to talk about it. It's another thing to see it. Plus we're going to,
we're have spoil spoilers. The shit
yeah.
out.
So, but, yeah, so the, and then I think why I became obsessed, as good as it was, I was also figuring out how the hell I'd never heard of these guys. I became obsessed because it is so finely tuned, and they make a really bold choice. Excuse me. I'm going to be honest. It bumped me, and I didn't like it. But I was obsessed with it because I felt like they were such good filmmakers. I missed something. Like they intended something, and yeah. something about it didn't. So when I went back and brought you to it and watched it, I kind of felt like I cracked the code and had this epiphany yeah. about. And this will get to the core of what we want to talk about today. We had this epiphany that not only was that movie about this thing, but that maybe this was something that these filmmakers, it was so profound to us that it was something and so well told that we thought that maybe this is a theme and something these filmmakers are about as artists, not just in this one story they've told. And so we went back and obsessed over the past body of work, which was three other movies. And feel like it does hold up, that these guys have been trying to say something to varying degrees of success for four movies, and we kind of feel like this fourth movie just knocked it out of the park,
knocked
even though the other
park.
Ones are
absolutely
pretty awesome, too.
Yeah, and I'll say this for the ending, and this is the really interesting thing about this craft and pretty much any other art form, is that when James' second viewing, when he brought me, when I finished the movie, I also had that reaction where it didn't exactly go the direction I thought it was going to go.
Yeah.
And usually, and especially with indie films, it had this, there's a lot of indie films that have these kind of non-endings, because the truth is it's very difficult to end a story well. And, a lot of times I see in indie films, they either don't have the courage to take a stronger stance for what they're trying to say, or they don't know how to put a cap on what it is that they're trying to say.
They know what to say, but they don't know how to say it.
A
ghost story, which came out recently, which is all about a ghost trying to find out this last message from his wife. And in the last frames of the movie, he gets the message, reads it without showing it to the audience, and he just disappears. And that's the ending. And while there is kind of a beauty in that, it also just...
It just rings vacant.
There is an emptiness to it, for sure.
There is. And so, like, that's a personal peeve of mine, especially with indie films. The funny thing about this film is that it totally didn't end initially in a way that I thought was satisfying. But ultimately, like, I felt a conclusion that I couldn't even cognitively process. I knew that there was something there. And there was a message and there was a statement, and the decisions that were made intentionally, and they weren't just, either out of laziness or, incompetence. And deep down, it was just one of the strangest feelings I rarely ever have, where, I felt okay about it, even though mentally I had a hard time. And then when talking about it with James afterwards, and he kind of walked me through his own theory, the whole thing crystallized and it made complete sense.
Yeah.
And it was one of those really cool moments where the hair just stands up on the back of your neck and you're like, oh my gosh, these guys are geniuses.
It reminds me of, I remember when I saw 2001 when I was younger, and I had this distinct feeling of going, I don't understand it, but that's because it doesn't mean something.
Yeah. Yep.
And I was really young, and it took me watching that movie multiple times and like writing four papers on it in college and like trying to figure out what the hell that movie was about. To, like, I think I do. Maybe I don't, but the, maybe that's the point, is that like everybody gets out of it what they're supposed to get out of it. But I do feel like there's something.
I do think the cool thing to highlight is that with art, it's about feeling, it's about the experience. And oftentimes there are movies that I watch that conclude that, that makes sense, but they just feel vapid. It feels wrong. It just doesn't make sense. And then by contrast, you have something like this that shocks you and jolts you, But then the message couldn't. Yeah,
I'm curious how you'd feel about the ending of Good Time if you saw it again, because my second time through, I just adored it. And the first time through, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I know that we're kind of talking in kind of broad terms right now. So why don't we do a little deep dive into, before we talk about their other movies, let's talk about what was it, the things other than the ending, what was it about Good Time that grabbed us and was so effective, and just talk about what the tools in their toolbox are that we'll get into later. So, so for me, I think the first thing that I noticed that I talked to you about, was their choice on how to lens particular scenes. So it opens up with a conversation between the younger brother, Benny, the actor's name is Benny, and his therapist. And basically it's an evaluation test of some sort to, you can tell they're trying to evaluate just the, what the intelligence level is of the younger brother. Presumably to put him into some sort of program or something. You don't know. They don't give you that context, but they're basically doing an intelligence test. And this entire scene is shot in close-up, and it's shot in long lens close-ups, as are the bulk of the movie. And what long lens, and Dave, I'm going to let you say what it is, because you know what it is better than me. I know what it is, but I may be wrong about how you achieve it. But essentially, it's you move the camera farther away from the person and zoom in, or get a longer lens that has the ability to zoom in.
Yeah.
So that the frame is really tight around the subject that you're filming, but it creates very narrow depth of field so that everything behind them is out of focus. So really the only thing you have to look at is the subject, right? Like that's kind of the idea of a shot like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The reason why you don't know is because like with a lot of things in our industry, terms apply. There'll be like two different terms that will apply to one type of shot or one type of shot that people will reference in like multiple different ways. So traditionally this shot that you're talking about is shot with a zoom lens, or just a nice long lens. And the shot is usually called a long shot, but a long shot also people use it to reference more of a wide shot where you see like an entire room.
You see the exact opposites. Yeah, exactly.
And so it is. So for the sake of this podcast, the point is they're taking telephoto shots, even in tight spaces. They're in a room and basically they take the shot so that it's a medium to medium close up. And you usually strategically in filmmaking, you want to use those close up shots when you're really trying to nail something home or you're making an emphasis on a character's reaction. Usually when they're at the pinnacle point of emoting. But it was really interesting with their style. They basically employed this shot, medium close-up, as pretty much the standard throughout the entire film.
Yeah, and one of the things that that does, the potential negative side of that, is that you never really see the geography of the sets and the locations where the scenes are taking place.
Yeah.
Which, particularly in a thriller... And in a thriller, it's oftentimes, oh, you got to run. You got to escape from the cops. You got to know the location where the drugs are that are the key point to what everybody wants in the scene. You just need to know the logistical geography of where things are in order for the story to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it through close-ups. It is incredibly difficult. Like that's, so that's the first thing I noticed was, oh man, like these guys are playing like for Major League Baseball. Like this is like, right? Like this is difficult, very difficult to do to construct a scene without the standard establishing shot to let the audience know exactly where they are, what the location is.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So yeah, that's the first thing I noticed. What else grabbed you about it when you started watching it?
You know, I think the two things that just stand out, like there's no escaping it, are the lens choices and really how they just had just the one long shot that they just ran with the entire time, but also the music and how the music really stitches everything together tonally.
Mm-hmm.
For
those of you that don't know, go, you can check out the Good Time soundtrack on iTunes or whatever. And it is, the movie is a very grounded, realistic, gritty New York crime thriller with very realistic characters and very realistic dialogue. There's no one-liners in this. This is just people talk very naturalistically. And then laid over the top of it is like a sci-fi thriller synth score straight out of the 80s, which is probably not really what it is. It's what it feels like. And they juxtapose those two elements to incredible effect. So it's very... Yeah. in your face. The score is very in your face at first. And then I found that after about 5 minutes, I almost didn't acknowledge it anymore because it was just
you get immersed
in it. And there's a lot of score in the movie. They don't stop very much. It's almost wall-to-wall music, it feels like.
Yeah. For those of you who have not seen the film, think the way their use of music is akin to like Christopher Nolan's approach to music in The Dark Knight, where there's almost always this music bed flowing and flowing and flowing. It's almost rhythmic. Theirs is just a lot harsher. It's this synthesis.
Dunkirk is another.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was not synth, but has a score that lays over the top of it that is pervasive and almost too aggressive and too as you sit and watch the movie, it makes your shoulders tense because you never have a break from it.
Yeah, and it fits well with the story because that's exactly the nature of the entire story. Is it starts in the beginning and then it just does not let up until the very end. It's always a tense situation. Even in the moments where you kind of take a sit back and you can take a breath because you need those, even those moments, there's still this element of the clock running out because it's always a race against time. So they manage to keep that momentum up, and the music is a big part of that.
Yeah, it's really something else. The other thing that I noticed right away was the quality of the performances and the way, I said this a little bit earlier, but the way that the dialogue sounded didn't sound like a movie. I would compare it to Jeremy Saulnier's movies a lot more, who did Blue Ruin and The Green Room.
Yeah.
Where, and if you don't know that director, one of the things that he's talked about is that he writes his own movies as well, and he strives to cut all exposition out of his movies, meaning no character will ever say something that you wouldn't say in real life. So you have to figure out the backstory and the situations purely from just what they're saying in a completely naturalistic way. So nobody comes into a room and says, Jimmy, I haven't seen you since 10 years ago when you divorced your wife, just because the screenwriter wants you to find out that they divorced their wife. Yeah. That's a perfectly valid way of writing, especially pulpier, you know, more mainstream things. But that was that. And that I wondered as I was watching it going like, first off, I thought Benny was actually mentally challenged. I had no idea who was the director. I really went, wow, they like, that's amazing. I knew what was going to happen in the story. So, but I remember going, he is so simple and childlike in his thought process. I wonder what that was like on set too.
Yeah.
Work with him.
Yeah. And then you find out he's not at all.
Yeah. He's this genius filmmaker. And so there is a verisimilitude to the acting that is not common, that was incredibly impressive. And then I came to find out that the other guy in that first scene is just a lawyer.
Wow.
And so was not a professional, maybe had done some acting or whatever, but it's not what you would call a professional, constantly working actor. And that is true for in later scenes in the Bond, what do you call it? Bond bailsman's, whatever. When they go to
the bail bondsman.
Like he was actually that guy, and that was actually his place of business. And the woman running the desk, they were just playing themselves.
Wow.
So this is obviously an approach, and having seen their previous films, like this is an approach that they use, and it creates, and it did two things for me. One, it just was incredibly emotional and really brought me into the world. And then the other side of that is that when the crazy kind of plot twisty things started to happen, I bought them hook, line, and sinker because everything was so realistic.
Yeah, so grounded.
And those twists are not ridiculous. They're pretty real. The big twist in the middle of the movie that I don't want to spoil yet is probably the riskiest kind of out there, but they just earned it. They earned it because everything else was so real. Anyway,
I agree with you. In fact, that's one of the things that I really appreciate about these filmmakers, just on the whole, is that this story, as I was watching it, I knew it's lower budget. I knew it was indie, and these guys were indie filmmakers. And sometimes I personally struggle with indie filmmakers in their stories because there's a kind of a disregard for classical structure. And I'm a bit of a classicist when it comes to structure. But the really cool thing about these guys is that the story, every step of the way, they leave no stone unturned.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, I knew exactly what the character wanted. I knew exactly why he was doing what he was doing. And as the situation kept escalating, one of the things that it was the thing that just kept me going through the entire film was the fact that even in the most extreme choices that the character would make, I always believed them.
Yeah.
And that's so central to following a story is even if you disagree, you have to understand why. And there has to be a level of empathy to connect you. And they do that surprisingly well throughout the entire story.
Yeah. The first sequence of the movie is he takes his younger brother with the mental problems and they hold up a bank. And then they get into a car, drive away, only to find that the bag of money that they got has a security device in it, like a paint bomb.
Yeah, like it's a paint bomb.
Which is, I remember even as I was watching it going, oh, that's brilliant. Like, because they become, literally, they become marked men.
Yeah.
And also in a low-budget film that you are striving to make visually dynamic and interesting, you now have two characters that are basically stained fluorescent pink. And I know it sounds like such a silly, unimportant thing. But I just remember going like that is, it's that attention to detail.
Yeah.
That can really elevate a movie beyond what it is. And then the next sequence too, when they have to hide the money and then try and clean up, you just have this great, very human moment where, of course, in an intense situation like this, where you're running from the cops, you're covered in paint that's going to mark you as the criminals that did it. In that situation, somebody with the mental problems that the mental challenges that the younger brother has are going to, panic and be overwhelmed.
They're gonna lose their bearings.
Yep. So you instantly, they very early establish this relationship between the two where you really see, oh, to a criminal mindset, the younger brother is now an anchor.
Yeah.
And automatically you have put these elements at play in the story that are going to increase tension, which is more exciting and for a thriller, but also force the characters into situations that will reveal themselves in a really dramatic way. Yeah. So automatically you have this fast talking, smooth talking criminal who now, should he abandon his younger brother or should he keep trying to work with him to save him? And he chooses to stick with him. Mm-hmm. And there's this incredible moment where they're trying to clean off the paint. And he just says to the younger brother, water, water, use water. And the younger brother, who's trying not to throw up in the toilet, just starts grabbing toilet water.
And throwing it on his face.
And it is, and I gasped when I saw that. I gasped. Yeah. I mean, it was such a brutal moment to see. It tells you so much about, he doesn't comprehend what is going on really at all.
Yeah.
And how brutal that must be. It's like taking an 8-year-old into a gunfight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's so much more dramatic. So that was, and then to see Connie, who's the older brother, his reaction to that is both like disgust and disdain. And he kind of says, like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, but is also freaked out when he sees it too. Like, you see the fear in his face of like what he has caused.
Yeah.
And so you see a genuine love for his younger brother as well. And like, that is such an important sequence to me, because in what is just a fast paced guerrilla style, exciting moment, they are feeding you character, which is incredible.
They're telling you about them individually, and they're telling you about the dynamic of the two of them together.
Yeah.
Which is the story at its heart. I want to talk about the meaning of the film as a whole.
Okay. And I think we can't do that without getting to the ending, right?
No, we're going to give spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
And swearing and drinking. You can't tell we're drinking too. So the movie then compounds upon himself. The younger brother is arrested. Connie takes the money that they stole and takes it to a bail bondsman to try and get his brother out of prison. And of course, he doesn't have enough because a lot of it was stained with the paint.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, failing that, knowing that he doesn't have enough money, he tries a couple things to get money.
Yeah, he tries to convince this girl that he's kind of dating, but it's pretty evident he's just really kind of using her, and she's just completely swept off her feet with him. She's just over the moon with this guy.
Yeah. Played by Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Oh, so great. She plays this kind of manic, like desperate for love and attention. And when that doesn't work, he tries to get her to charge an amount of money on her mother's credit card. It falls through. And then it's really interesting the way they treat that relationship, because it's early on, it's kind of this bigger point where he goes to her as a place of refuge almost. And And then what ends up happening with that relationship is the second she can't come through for him, he just kind of leaves her, and the entire story moves on
and she's
past
out,
her.
And she's out of the story. It's almost
like
a road trip.
Out of the story.
She was just a stop on a road trip.
Yep. And that's the case for a lot of the characters throughout. As long as, because everything focuses on Pattison's character, Connie, right? Mm-hmm. We come to see progressively with Connie that he loves people, but he uses them.
Mm-hmm.
And to varying degrees with his brother, I would say that the love that he shares for his brother is the most pure. But even still, he brings his brother in on a bank heist.
Yeah. So there's a selfishness.
Yeah, there's a selfishness built into that.
But also they want the money to get away. The stated reason is to escape and have a better life. And he wants to use that money for his brother. Also with Jennifer Jason Leigh, again, to continue to drive that point home, while he ultimately does manipulate her and just kind of move on from her, when he first shows up, the way that Pattinson plays it is that when he shows up to collect Jennifer Jason Leigh and she's having a fight with her mother about him being there, he does back off and offer to leave and feels kind of reticent about the situation.
And then
she invites him in, and you honestly don't know, is that just a masterstroke ploy?
Yeah.
Or is it genuine? I don't know.
Yeah.
I read it as kind of genuine.
Yeah.
But then it still got him what he wants. But yeah, but
details like that are really important because it creates a complex character. It's so small and so nuanced, but it at least doesn't allow you to just paint him in a singular light.
Exactly.
You can see the conflict that's going on within him.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that plays out throughout the rest of the story.
Because he's constantly a real person doing things that you may never do, but it allows you to empathize with the actions that he's doing.
So absolutely.
So at the bail bondsman, he finds out that his brother is no longer in jail, although he is under police guard at a hospital because he got into a fight in the
jail. Altercation at the prison.
So his next idea is to sneak into the hospital and break his brother out of the hospital when he's under less guard.
Yeah.
Does this in very simple but clever ways. And they start to use the fact that he is a fast talker as more than like a Scorsese-ism or something like, hey, it's a crime thriller. You have a fast talking criminal. You start to really see that's even more so that's his superpower.
He
uses it to weasel out information from a janitor where prisoners might be kept in the hospital without making it look like he's just asking where a prisoner is kept to draw attention to himself. Mm-hmm. It's very well written.
He uses it to sneak information from people that otherwise wouldn't give it. He uses it to coerce people into doing things that they wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah.
It's the thing that he hinges everything on.
Yep.
It's his one ability that he knows how to manipulate very tactfully.
And then he eventually zeroes in where his brother is kept. And then there's just a great, great moment. And again, all that's really happening on a plot level is that he finds out where his brother is in the hospital and has to sneak by the guard. And he just kind of has to wait out for a little bit and wait for the guard to leave and then sneak in and get him. Pretty simple stuff. The way that they go about this is that he rounds a corner and is standing in full view of the police officer. So again, he kind of does his fast-talking shtick to get past him and to kind of alleviate the tension of why is he just walking down this dark hallway when there's a prisoner there. And he tells the cop a story about his dead father.
Yeah.
To get out of the situation.
Yeah,
which is very spooky and weird and ultimately a throwaway. But I remember when I was watching it going, I wonder if that means something or whatever. And then sure enough, in an interview with the directors, they talked a lot about how the best lies are always just based in like some real life thing. So that the liar can kind of keep track of it and feel real about it. And in their minds, they did have that his father had died in a hospital or had died. And that like, so anyway, but it's a very human detail. And then more importantly is Connie sneaks into the room adjacent to his brother's where an old woman is staying and very, disconcerted that a strange man is standing in her room. And there's this incredible moment again, where he takes her apple juice sitting on a tray and he peels it and he gives her some.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he takes the other half of it and drinks it himself.
Right.
That moment is so again, constantly not trying to drive home who the character is, because I don't know if that was it scripted. I don't know if the director came up with it. I don't know if the actor came up with it. But whoever came up with it, it was organic to the story and who the character was. And when those moments happen, they're constantly reminding the audience who they're watching.
Yes. And you know what I'm going to add to that is one of those great moments because one of the expressions as a writer that you hear is that plot comes from character. Plot and character are actually kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
That's a great example of it because essentially when he goes into that room, she starts to panic and he opens the apple juice to kind of keep her from panicking. So it kind of progresses the plot in a manner of speaking, but it's also it coincides exactly with his character where he doesn't go and he doesn't rough her up. He doesn't put his hand over her mouth. He doesn't try to find a forceful way to do it.
Yep.
He charms her. And then this, you know, he gives her the drink of the apple juice and then drinks it himself. And that's just the highlight into
who he is. Because he's thirsty too.
Yeah, he's thirsty too. Why not?
And it's kind of communal.
Yep.
But it's also a little selfish. It is complicated. Every moment is complicated on a character level. It's great. Ultimately, the guard leaves. He steals his brother out, who has a super bruised face and is in a big neck brace. And the big twist in the middle, spoiler, is that the guy that he breaks out of the hospital is actually not his brother.
Yeah.
And he gets carried away in a whole other criminal endeavor with a whole other set of criminals that ultimately leads to him being trapped in, like, what would you say, like a 10 to 12 story high apartment building?
Yeah. Yeah. He ends up colluding with this other criminal and goes on this wild goose chase looking for money. He ends up getting trapped with that guy up in like a 10, 12 story high up apartment building condo kind of thing. And then that guy starts to turn on him. So he's got to get away.
Yeah. And then it's worth mentioning, we were talking about those tight close-ups. Other than the opening scene, every single scene is with Connie, with Robert Pattinson. And because this is a tight character-based thriller, other than just a few brief moments, we've never left Connie's side. We are always, we're not literally seeing through his point of view, like the camera is his eyes. It's not a Gaspar Noé film, but it is is as close to that as you can get in a straight narrative way. Like you never, the camera's like always looking over his shoulder. It's always right in his face. It's always from his point of view in the sense that you only know what he knows.
Uh-huh.
And then we get to this ending where he's trapped and he flees from the building. And rather than go with him, the filmmakers decided to stay with this other criminal. And you actually watch what happens to Connie from a 12-story high apartment building with presumably Robert Pattinson or a stunt double running around on the ground below.
Yeah.
And they go from this incredibly intimate cinematic experience to being 12 stories away.
Yeah. A bird's eye view. Suddenly because you see him that Pattinson leaves and it's the most jarring thing in the world. And this is where we come to that
ending that we talked about.
Yeah, the ending that we talked about where we're scratching our heads going, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. It's incongruous with the entire rest of the story.
Yeah.
But Pattinson leaves and contrary to what you expect, the camera stays with the other random criminal in the apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
And we follow him over to the window where he looks over the balcony and we see Pattinson leave the building and we've got this bird's eye view of him and it just doesn't make any sense. It's jarring. I remember like just cocking my head back going, wait, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. And the cops, and after all of these narrow escapes, all of this daring do, all of this cat and mouse, the cops drive up. Jump out, chase him, pin him to the ground, and arrest him.
Yeah. No, it's the most anticlimactic thing you can imagine.
Yeah. And obviously a divisive moment. And it's also worth mentioning that they don't just chase him a few feet. He does go back and forth through kind of a walkway area with cement sides. It's hard to tell how high they are because of the way they shot it, but he's kind of running back and forth, left and right before they catch him. That's worth mentioning for future reference.
It's a walkway for like people who are in a wheelchair or something like that. You know, it zigzags so that the ramp isn't too steep.
And then literally the last three sequences of the movie are then the cops go after the secondary character who you're left with. He attempts to leave the apartment, plummets to his death.
Yeah.
And then you are back with the younger brother with the mental problems and the therapist from the beginning scene. And they take him and they put him into a class with other people with mental disabilities who were all played by actual people with disabilities. And as the credits roll, we just watch as this character is asked to play a game that essentially has no purpose. It is just an act. Well, I'm sure that the therapist would disagree, but
the audience,
a layman like me don't really know, but the game is essentially stand on that side of the room. I'm going to say that I love something. If you love it too, you walk to the other side of the room and then you do it again and you do it again and you do it again. And they just go back and forth doing this for seemingly no purpose, back and forth, while the credits roll over an amazing Iggy Pop song that we can talk about at the end. Yeah. So, and it's technically kind of an anti-climax given the genre that they chose, right?
Yeah. Because the entire rest of the movie is, it's very classically structured. Mm-hmm. Like, everything builds off of the scene before it. Every character action puts him,
every action has an equal opposite reaction.
Yes. It builds.
Yeah. And it builds.
And then all of a sudden it just goes poof.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, what?
Yeah. And so it was that Scooby-Doo moment that led me to get Dave to watch it. And it was on. So should I just get into my theory and why we're all this crap?
Yeah, you know what? And I'll just say this. I'm glad initially James and I, we were going to watch it together, and then he bailed on me, went to go see it for himself. But I'm kind of glad it happened that way, because he had already formed a theory that I think is very tenable. And I was able to get that immediately after watching the film, and had, I think, a cooler experience being able to like collect all the thoughts and the meaning in that same moment.
Yeah. So my theory is this, is that the reason why they chose to shoot that ending this way is because, for one, it's you pointed this out too, it's kind of a godlike perspective looking down on Connie.
Yeah.
And Connie is a fast-talking, smooth-talking guy who is very intelligent, but also probably thinks he's more intelligent than he is, and is surrounded by criminal riffraff.
Yeah.
And he doesn't view himself as that. His entire mission is just give me this money that I earned somehow, even though he stole it.
Yeah.
Give me what I deserve so I can pull myself out of this world and get my brother out of this world.
Yeah.
Which has a sense of deserving to it, a sense of
entitlement.
Entitlement.
Yeah.
But by shooting it from up above, he's literally like running through a maze.
Yeah.
A little bug or a mouse in a maze.
Yeah.
And it is a very striking image because, again, they've shot the whole thing in close-ups.
Yeah.
So it's also, by saving a long, big establishing shot, they have given it a visual potency that it wouldn't normally have.
Yes.
Because even if you're not thinking that consciously, you're reacting almost physiologically to like, oh, everything's open now.
Yeah.
Like, but yet he's still trapped and he's still in this little maze running back and forth through this wheelchair access area.
Yeah. And I'll just step in and say this, is that that was actually the exact moment that the hair stood up on the back of my neck. Is the movie ended and James started walking me through some of this as I was trying to put it together. And he just asked me a question. He goes, okay, that high up shot, you know, looking down at him, you see him running away. Because it's also very intentional that they have this little running away scene. It's not like a big...
They could have just pulled the guns and shot him or jumped on him. But instead, there is a little bit of a foot chase that goes on.
And you're watching it because
you're watching it like, come on, Connie, you can do this. Connie, you've done such like bigger, more incredible things. Yeah. Oh, no, you just got tackled like a bum.
You're just a loser.
No, it's true.
It's so pathetic. It's not this big, epic, like, chase scene that ends with him getting caught. He just runs, like, a little distance, and he gets nailed.
Yeah.
And then James just asked me the question. He goes, that shot, what does he look like to you? And immediately, I didn't, like, immediately, the image popped in my head, and I was like, oh, he looks like a mouse in one of those mazes. That's exactly what I feel like I'm looking at. And I'll let you continue from there. I just
Totally. Yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah. And then Connie leaves the movie. He gets arrested, and then he's not in the final scenes. They talk about him, but you know, presumably he's arrested and has been to some sort of trial or hearing or whatever. You don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you follow the younger brother, who goes. And I guess this is something that we forget. A pretty major important thing that we forgot to mention. In that opening scene where the brother is doing an interview to kind of like an intake interview.
Yes.
Connie comes in and grabs him out and goes, "You don't belong here. You don't belong here."
Yeah. Yep. So
then,
important.
Right. So key. Important. Right. So key. And late. And then they go and rob a bank like you do with your brother, just hanging out. And then right before this ending that we're talking about, Connie and this other criminal that he's come into cahoots with have a conversation about their place in the world. And it's revealed that Connie says very deliberately, I'm better than you. I'm better than you. You're just a criminal, but I'm something more, even though he's just another criminal. So after Connie is arrested, we go back to this younger brother with that same therapist who has now presumably been accepted into the program that he was being evaluated for. And it is literally just standing in a room, walking left, walking right, walking left, walking right, with no discernible reason or goal. And as this happens, they start to roll credits. And they roll credits over this very beautiful song that was written by the composer and I think he did the – I'm not sure who did the lyrics – and Iggy Pop, who performs it. And on the second time through, afterwards, I listened to the lyrics. And I was – because I was like, why are they – a lot of movies cut to black over credits. And the movie had been so – technically self-assured, like assured of itself, right? Like, is that the right word?
It was very calculated.
Everything was so calculated that I went, okay, like, why are they just continuing to show these images of the brother going back and forth and have all this dialogue mm-hmm. as we roll credits and music? Mm-hmm. So, and the lyrics, I should have pulled them up before I mentioned this, but hold on. I'm going to pull up the lyrics to the song. Yeah. Okay, you say something interesting while I'm looking this up.
Oh, okay. So this is also key to the point of the story. Is when he's okay. So we have the therapist that we open the movie with, and he also concludes the movie. And he's with Benny Safdie's character, the mentally challenged brother, and he's walking him to the room where the other mentally challenged patients are. And as he's walking him there, very nonchalantly, he makes a comment that I think the entire message of the narrative hinges on. He says something to the extent of, your brother is where he belongs and you are where you belong. And he says it so casually that you kind of just move past it. And you don't think about it until you really take the story as a whole. And then the message becomes very clear. And this coincides exactly with what James is talking mm-hmm. about with the shot staying on Benny as they're doing this exercise in the room and the credits are going. And initially, that's also one of those things that I would have just thought kind of flippantly that they just, okay, they thought this was a cool idea, have the credits go over the scene and maybe it's really pretty looking, but there's a reason and there's a purpose. And this is why I really appreciate these guys as filmmakers, is because they want that image and they're driving something home and you can feel it even though you're not exactly sure what it is. But I'll let James read the lyrics to the song that is the music bed for this, the culmination.
Sequence. Yeah.
The culmination movie. That is the sequence.
And I'm not going to sing it. I'm not going to read all of them, although another drink and I may sing it. So the main lyrics are, the pure always act from love. The damned always act from love. Every day I think about untwisting and untangling these strings I'm in and lead to a pure life. I look ahead at a clear sky. Ain't going to get there, but it's a nice dream.
The pure always act from love. The damned always act from love. The truth is an act of love.
And then I think the final, there's a lot of other lyrics that really play into this, but then one of the things they say near the end, right as the movie is closing, is, someday I swear we're going to go to a place where we can do everything we want to. Which speaks to like the entire movie about two brothers trying to escape this shitty, poor, crime-infested New York life.
Yeah, they are the low lives of the city.
Right. But also the other key things to this are obviously the thriller aspects speak to every day I think about untwisting and untangling these strings I'm in, which describes so perfectly the entire movie.
Yeah.
Being trapped in a string. Have you ever untangled a knot and it takes you an hour, right? Because it's like been your headphones crammed in your desk drawer for like 2 years. It's the most frustrating thing in the world. It's such an accurate lyric. And that's how the entire movie feels, by A, using the claustrophobic close-ups and using this pulsating, driving, relentless score. That's exactly how you feel at the end of the movie. And the hopelessness and in the brutal, simple way with at the end of the movie, Connie just gets randomly tackled by a couple of cops that had just happened to show up at the perfect time.
Yeah.
And taken down just speaks to the lyrics like, ain't gonna get there, but it's a nice dream, right?
Yeah.
And so you start to reevaluate this entire movie that you've seen. You've seen a character who hates the fact that his younger brother is being viewed as
less than.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I even struggle to phrase it that way, because they're not doing it in a negative way. They are just seeing that he has limitations and he needs to be cared for in a certain way. Right.
Yes.
And that just rubs Connie the wrong way, to the point that he tries to take his brother on to do something that, even if it was legal, well, it does, this is kind of a silly thing to say, because it went, but he shouldn't take him in any type of intense situation where he can't handle himself properly. Like, if you know what I mean? But he also does it out of love, because they're taking a risk to try and have a better life.
Yes.
And then so ultimately you reveal over the course of the movie that but he's doing exactly, as a character, what he kind of detests that therapist for doing. Mm-hmm. Right? He's looking down at all the other people around him who are also criminals, because those are the circles that he runs in.
In fact,
hates them for it.
Yeah, that's the whole speech he has with that other criminal when they're up in the apartment room 12 stories up, is they get into an argument, and Connie basically gives him the spiel where he tries to tell the other guy, look, you're just a lowlife. You're not anybody. You're going to be doing the same things over and over, and you're just a loser, and you'll always be a loser, essentially. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And really, by the end of the movie, you realize that the reason why he has so much hatred and the reason why he's so angsty about this is because that's how he deeply feels about himself, and that's what he's trying to overcome.
And ultimately just fails, because ultimately we're just a rat in a maze. Ultimately, cops just come out of nowhere and smack you down. Ultimately, nothing you do works.
The thing that I took from that, the very nature of the anticlimactic small chase scene, the cops showing up, they tackle him, and then he's just in jail. Like, the movie feels like it just comes to this abrupt stop. The more I thought about it, it almost feels obligatory, because whether it was that moment or the dozen other moments he almost got caught before, who he is and what he's doing is just, he is damned to this kind of an outcome.
Yep.
So the movie could go on for another hour, but eventually he will get caught, and he'll go to jail.
And
like,
almost by not doing it in a clever, cathartic way, it forces you to really think about the thematic elements of it more.
Yeah,
it
totally.
It's that perfect example of breaking a rule that is generally correct.
Yes.
Generally, you don't just want to have an ending, because he could have gotten tackled by a cop at any point.
Yes.
It could have, you know what I mean? Everything's kind of a direct response to his general actions in regards to things. Yep. But like, it's not like, oh, it was the fact that he picked up that one business card that led the cops to him at that place. There's no connective tissue. There's no plot element other than the cops may have just been driving by. I guess you assume that because the dog is barking, maybe somebody called the cops. But that's all. They never explain it.
Yeah. You know, I think this is really important too. I want to highlight the fact that this is why I fundamentally think that the story works, is because we have an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And the nature of an anti-hero is that, okay, as a protagonist and as a hero in like 99.9% of every movie, it's about watching that character go through a change. It could be good and bad. It could be bad to good. It could be from generous to selfish, or selfish to generous. There's always a change that occurs. But with an anti-hero, the point of the anti-hero is telling a story of what happens when a character doesn't change. And the thing with Connie's character is he is the exact same in the beginning and the exact same at the end, which is why a traditional arc and conclusion would not have worked mm-hmm. because there was nothing that he was learning. There weren't changes that he was making. He just keeps doing the same things, same selfish things. They just keep ramping up. Yeah. And in the end, he loses. And ultimately, I believe the point there is that he was damned to lose because he's trying to change his circumstances without trying to change his character. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately why he's damned to the conclusion that he mm-hmm. is, why he ends up, quote unquote, where he belongs.
Yeah, absolutely. It's similar to, but not similar type of character, but it reminds me of the movie Nightcrawler, and that the arc of the story does not come from the main character changing. It comes from the audience's understanding of that character.
Yes.
In Nightcrawler, yes. he is a pure villain and mm-hmm. terrifying. In this one, Connie is not what I actually wouldn't call him a villain. Although he's flawed almost to the brink of being a villain. Yeah. Like everything is his fault. But just goes to show that those kind of like screenwriting rules of everybody's got to have an arc in this and that, like that can mean more than you think it means.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so there's two messages, depending on how optimistic you want to be. One is that people are who they are and you're not going to transcend, whatever kind of,
your nature.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, and it's probably one and the same message really, but the other slightly more optimistic is, look, you're not going to change your circumstances until you change your mm-hmm. character.
Yeah. No, I was going to say it's more. Yeah, exactly. If you like, because Benny, while he definitely has, I keep calling the character Benny, the actor who plays him is Benny, the younger brother, while he may never have the mental capacity of somebody who doesn't have whatever disability it is that he has, uh-huh. by going to those classes and doing these therapies and being around these people, these things that he's never had access to because Connie has kept him from them, maybe he will achieve something else, a better life.
Yeah, let's call it that. Potentially, yeah.
Better life, yeah. Right? The accepting who you are is the only thing that could potentially lead to you changing who you are.
Yeah.
Right? Like, because if you deny it and ignore it, you're just caught in the same patterns because you're refusing to acknowledge them.
Yes. And I think that this would be a good segue to talk about the earlier work.
Oh, I thought you were going to confront me about something or like...
No, that's a good segue.
This is why you need
drinking
to...
problem.
Yeah, yeah. exactly. I'm going to start my 9 steps. No, the 12 steps. The, I don't even know how many steps there are. So that led to, I found it. And again, just talking about it really doesn't really drive home how profound it is. I guess a lot of it depends on here.
That's right.
Second glass. Obviously we're talking about things like describing something to you that you may not have seen. A lot of it is the execution of how these things are done are partly what makes it so powerful.
Yes.
But how it was profound enough and just kind of like knocked me back on my heels enough that it was like, okay, like I got to go check out these guys' other work and really see like, is this something they've been working towards? Because I do believe that a lot of directors kind of have a general theme that mm-hmm. you see throughout their work, Kubrick uh-huh. and others. Or is this just what is it? I just wanted to see more. And so I went back and watched, they've done 3 movies that you should, and I would recommend all of them, although I would have to say to the more casual viewer, the latter two are probably the most accessible.
Yeah. Because Daddy Long Legs is far more of an indie film, and it's a bit more of a character drama. Yeah. It doesn't hold to any traditional, it'd be very difficult to access it.
The things I noticed that were so different and similar, and it was really interesting. So their first film was called The Pleasure of Being Robbed. So just alone that title kind of fits into the world, right? Kind mm-hmm. of the world of Good Time. But it's about this girl who's a fast talker, a kind of a trickster character, shares a lot of similarities with Connie. And the opening scene, which is probably the best scene, not to drag the movie through the mud, but it's just great, is she is walking down a street in New York and she sees a woman walking down the street and starts calling out random names. Hey, Connie. Hey, Judith. Hey, Edith. Hey, whatever. And then when she gets to one where the woman responds, she goes, "Oh, hey, it's you." And she runs over and gives her a big hug, starts talking fast about, like, when was the last time we saw each other? Like, and the other woman wanting to be nice, like, plays nice, thinking maybe she forgot her. And she uses this technique to steal her purse. And that's the opening scene. Mm. And so, again, like, instantly it was like, okay, from they were 21 years old when they made their movie. Actually, I think just Josh made the first movie, just one of the brothers on his own. But already we're seeing these themes of here's somebody doing a terrible thing, but in a charming way, a nonviolent way. She made that woman feel better about her day until she goes home and finds out her purse is gone. The other thing that was very different that I noticed, one is an almost lack of score. They had not yet begun to do this what they were doing with their modern movie, their more recent movies with the score, but also little to no narrative drive, even less narrative drive than Daddy Long Legs. What I mean by that, by narrative drive, is that a character's action leads to the next sequence that you see, and that something that the character does in that sequence leads logically to the next sequence as a reaction to whatever they did, right? Mm-hmm. You punch a cop in the face, then you go to jail, then you break out of jail, then whatever. You know what I mean? So, like, whereas this movie would be like, I punch a cop in the face and then I go get ice cream, which is a non sequitur, right? Yeah. Life works in non sequiturs. Mm-hmm. Not always. So there is definitely cause and effect. But in most dramatic narrative, the general rule of thumb is the better it is, the more interconnected it is in terms of logic and probability and necessity and the character actions leading to the next sequence that you see. And in their early two films, they have very little of that. Although Good Time is their more recent movie is one of the best written thrillers I may have ever seen. What I did notice that was so similar to what they're doing now is they shot most of the film, most of it, not all of it, but most of it in these long lens close-ups that they were doing. So this is obviously, and what I was taken with was at that stage in their career, and the movie, as near as I can understand, was literally made with no money. Like, they just made it with their friends and whatever was in their pockets. It was a style probably more born out of necessity. And you talked about that too, a little bit about how when you have less money, the close-up can help you. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I'd actually love to talk about that. So, their style and their approach with these telephoto shots is not anything particularly new to the indie world, and I can explain. The reason why this is kind of a thing that's exploded on the indie front, people taking these really close-up shots and using them more often, is because you can control the light a lot easier. When you're shooting a wide shot and you've got an entire room or a department store or whatever your location is, when you're trying to capture everything in the frame, the camera doesn't capture light the way your naked eye does. Mm. Your eye is pretty incredible, actually. It knows how to balance different intensities of light really well. And the camera can't do that. So a lot of times the light is just completely imbalanced, which is one of the most one of the reasons why movie making is so expensive, is because cinematographers have to go in and balance all of the light, and then they have to create a mood with it, and that's what takes the most time. That's what takes the most money. So when you don't have time, when you don't have money, and you're making an independent film, the easiest thing to do is to shoot. Mostly or predominantly closer up shots, because you can control the light, and generally it's just more interesting. You get a strong depth of field, and you can kind of move the camera around and focus on things, keep it a little bit shaky, just keep the energy moving, keep it going. The problem with that is, and I'd say one of the reasons why I don't like most indie films, is because when you're young, you don't really know what you're doing. You're just doing things because they look good, but then it's very superficial and it doesn't have meaning and it doesn't convey tone or emotion very well. Mm-hmm. Cause you're just doing something cause it looks pretty. The difference with this film, and initially when I saw all their close-up shots, cause I saw Good Times first, I thought the same thing. Oh, okay. Well, they're just doing this because, you know, that's what you do as an indie filmmaker to make a $2 budget look better than it is. And I don't know how much intention was behind it, but considering all of the other elements at play, I have to imagine that they know enough of what they're doing. They took their limitations and used it for a purpose. So because their earlier films and even up to Good Times, they're very strongly character motivated. And most of their earlier films are basically character pieces, even on a minimalist level. What they're doing is instead of taking each scene and directing it so that there's a specific emphasis, what they're doing is they're using their shots and they're conveying an overall tone and a mood that works for their stories and their subject matter. And I'll give you an example. The world that we're living in Good Times, and even their earlier films, Daddy Long Legs and Heaven Knows What, they have a penchant for, if I want to use the word, kind of the low lives of society, the ones that are always hustling, the ones that are just, they're kind of directionless in life. But they live in a side, in a corner of the city that is really chaotic. It's very uncertain. It follows no inherent patterns. There's no routines or anything. It's just fly by the seat of your pants. And so everything about these telephoto shots convey a few things. They convey the chaotic nature of the world that they exist in. There's almost an exclusion of everything else, that the only thing that matters is what's literally going on in that moment between those characters. And
which makes a lot of sense when you're dealing with a lot of selfish characters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're only focused on themselves. They're only focused on what's going on in the media. There's no sense of an awareness of society at large, of the other people at large. Everybody only interacts with them. Everybody's importance is only to the degree that it helps or is disadvantageous to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we create this chaotic tone, this chaotic mood, this uncertain world that we're living in, which is really emblematic of what that would be like. And then simultaneously, it works on both ways. So they're not just shooting something because it looks good. They're shooting it because it looks good, but they're utilizing it for the purpose of elevating the story.
Exactly.
Which is what, in my opinion, sets them apart from not only other indie filmmakers, but truthfully, most other seasoned, successful filmmakers out there who don't really understand what they're doing. These guys know how to incorporate even their limitations to elevate the craft.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them geniuses in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. It's incredible. And you can see them evolve into that in a lot of ways. In Daddy Long Legs, I also just think by requirement, they are required to have some wider shots because you're constantly following three main characters. The dad's the main character, but then the two boys.
Yeah.
But what you can really see whenever possible, they pop back into those close-ups. They also, in those films, they don't have the visual control that they have, that they do in Good Time, right? Because of budgetary reasons and because of what they wanted to do to play with color and stuff in Good Time.
Uh-huh.
So Daddy Long Leg is a lot more flat, natural lighting. It's a, I hate to say it, it's an uglier movie.
Yeah, like, uglier, yeah, I mean, absolutely.
That's relative. There's just, and it's just, you know, the look works for that movie. It's totally fine.
Uh-huh.
But they just had less control of it because they knew, I don't know, they knew they weren't going to have that lighting anyway. So they chose to control the thing that they could control, which is so, so smart. And I think a real definitive change, turn in their body of work is between Daddy Long Legs and Heaven Knows What. Kind of for two major reasons. Both the first two early films deal with people that do things that are wrong or if not flatly criminal. People that have a high energy level, that are trying to game the system, that are manipulative, show a real empathy and love for people, but it's at battle with their own selfishness, right? That's true of like their entire body of work.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty amazing, right? But what does shift between Daddy Long Legs and Heaven Knows What is this concept of narrative propulsion. Heaven Knows What, while it does not have the same thriller aspects as Good Time, feels a lot like a thriller at times.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the difference is the character, even though it changes, in Good Time you have a character who constantly wants to free his brother. Right?
Yeah.
Both from the shackles of what society wants of him and then literally from prison. In Heaven Knows What, her goal constantly keeps shifting. I want to be with this guy. I want to be with this guy. And then I want the drugs. I want my next fix because it's about heroin addicts. And ultimately it's about the guy, but it keeps shifting. But still, it's like they inherently knew or they inherently wanted to add this. They wanted I don't know. I can't speak to what their intentions were, but you can definitely see that they wanted characters to be a little bit more active about what they wanted. Whereas their first two films are about people being disaffected and unhappy with their state.
Yes.
Right.
But then never doing the things that would actually get them out of it.
They are in survival mode, which is a term my wife and I use all the time. You go to survival mode. It's not about getting ahead. It's about keeping your nose above water.
Yes.
Right. That's, and then their second two films are about people that are barely keeping their nose above water, but want to get fully out of the water.
Yes.
Right. Yep. In Heaven Knows What, it's a little bit less clear because she is a drug addict. It's not like she wants to get off drugs or something like that, but she does want to retain a relationship with this guy. So it's definitely a stair step. And it's also the first film where they start playing with color more, right? Mm-hmm. At least in a couple of sequences, which are the sequences that got them much more noticed, which is interesting. The bulk of the movie feels a lot like Daddy Long Legs, where it's natural lighting, handheld camera out on the streets, right? But then whenever they're in interiors, they start to control their light more than they ever have before.
Yeah, and it's significantly easier to do that, especially in the smaller confined spaces that they predominantly shot the film in.
Yeah.
These small, tiny apartments and back rooms of other people's places. And I think back to one of my favorite moments, like to bring up in another filmmaker, Robert Rodriguez, when he made his first film, El Mariachi, he has a few scenes where the light, when you look at the image, it's actually pretty dynamic and it's not as refined or polished as a big time Hollywood produced film, but it's just a really cool, compelling image. And, it's one of the things that he was most credited with at film festivals, where some of these scenes where the light was just really cool looking. And he would laugh because he literally had three pan lights, three of those like Home Depot type of pan lights with one floodlight bulb in the middle, and he put diffusion over it. And he would just set those up wherever he would go. But because he understood the camera, because he understood how to manipulate an image, he could throw those up and could come out with something really compelling, which is a huge achievement when you're working with a $2 budget, and especially when contrasted with other films that don't have that kind of intuition about even the smallest things like that.
Yeah. The other thing that they really evolved into was using the score more cinematically. You can see that that's a tool that they found. Yeah. That's something that comes into play in Heaven Knows What. And it's really useful because all of their films, including Good Time, are very talky, people expressing what they want. And when you want to create this higher sense of tension and constantly reminding people what is at stake, the score can be incredibly useful for that.
Oh, yeah.
And they went bold with it, which is amazing. And they chose a style, and they may not always do this, but for their next two movies, they chose synth. And they chose very aggressive, I don't want to say percussion because it's synth, but it has a driving beat to it that's really intense, that is arguably incongruous with their shooting style.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your first choice.
Yeah.
For you would think like a soft jazzy piano music or something for these stories about people walking down the street and getting into arguments with their loved ones. And it adds an element to their work. Not that they always need to use synth or anything like that, but by really using music as a tool for the first time in their third film, it elevated their work a lot in my mind. Heaven Knows What, just really, it's one of the things that really takes it to the next, to the next level in my mind.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's understandable why that was the first one where they really got noticed and why Robert Pattinson wanted to work with them.
Yeah. Yeah. The music is one of the things that immediately just punches you in the face from the get-go. And you realize this isn't another derivative indie film. This is something that's going to resonate with you. And it holds your attention, and it kind of almost demands your attention from the get-go. And you give it, and you're not disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so maybe to kind of conclude, we can talk about what we hope to see from these guys in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that a lot because we talk about this. Like, to me, all of their films are about people who are stuck where they are, trying to make things better, often almost always resorting to some sort of crime or negative social act to achieve it, and how ultimately it never works.
Yes.
Whether they're punished or not is inconsequential. It like never works for them.
And to me, good time, that was something I thought, because I went, well, how do you say that better than good time did? Yeah. And I'm not entirely sure. And I have like this theory that I get when I'm drunk, which I am now, that that you know, I mean, like most things, there's a bell curve to them. And I often find that an artist has a bell curve to their body of work. And I think that you can see it in a lot of mainstream, in terms of film, you can see it in a lot of mainstream directors.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think we're at the back half of that bell curve with a lot of people. So I always, and I think it may be connected to when you kind of run out, when you have said the thing that you want to say as many times as you can in as many unique ways as you can, mm-hmm. how is there left to say it?
Yes.
And I really think that truly great art really has something to say. It doesn't need to be a preachy film, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Good Time is such a potent version of the previous three films that they made.
Yeah, they definitely graduate. And the message, it's almost like the thing that comes to my mind is when you go to an eye doctor and you get an eye exam and he has you read that chart across the room with each respective film of theirs, it's the focal lens gets that much clearer, that much sharper up until Good Time where it's like, oh, I see this crystal clear. I get it. I understand it. And it couldn't be more potent. So now I think the question arises, where do you go from here?
Yeah. There's a part of me that wants them to go somewhere almost wholly new. But then again, I used to feel that way about Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
and that dude has managed to carve out a much more specific niche than these guys have.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where you're like, oh, it's a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
But if you really look at all their movies, they're all variations on a theme. They are slight, both aesthetically and thematically, right? Like, so they're all incredibly related. But when you look at them by their own standard of measure, they're very different. Life Aquatic is a straight out fantasy.
Yeah.
Almost cartoony fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And comparatively, like the Royal Tenenbaums is much, much more grounded. But then you take
that's very comparative because Royal Tenenbaums is
these are all
compared to each other
And that's my point. So like then you look at Grand Budapest Hotel, which takes a lot of the more larger scope fantasy like elements of Life Aquatic,
but
brings that emotional gravity of Royal Tenenbaums.
Mm-hmm.
So and Darjeeling Limited. So it's he's constantly. You think he has the most limited toolbox of any director you've seen because it's like, it's a one-trick pony. But all of his movies have been, in my opinion, great. So that's – yeah. So I wonder – there's a part of me that's scared that they will go further down that line. Although I will say this, the one major element that they added to their magic cauldron of incredibleness is that Good Time is their first genre film. It's the first time where they went, I'm going to make a thriller as opposed to I'm just going to make a movie.
I'm just going to tell this story. They stuck with genre conventions for the most part. Yeah.
And I wonder if playing with genres and with those elements. Also, there's some ingredient we're not seeing too. Like that's the thing is like, I can't wait to be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah.
By what the hell they do next.
Yeah. I'm really curious. I hope that, I think... The simplest way to say this is I hope they don't beat a dead horse with this message, but if they do want to continue and if there is more that they see that they're willing to tell, hopefully it's new and it's invigorating and it's also compelling. But given the work that we've seen from them so far, I have all the belief in the world that they're going to come out with something that's that resonates.
They're easily the most exciting directors I have seen in a long time.
Yeah. Coming out on the indie front to the limelight. They couldn't deserve it more. And I have a lot of faith in these guys.
Yeah. So check out their movies. Good Times in Theaters right now. Heaven Knows What is on Netflix and everything else is on iTunes.
Yeah. iTunes. I saw Daddy Long Legs on YouTube of all places. But yeah, all available.
Check them out.
All right.
Did we forget to talk about anything else?
Nope.
All right.
I'm going to finish off this bottle of tequila.
All right. And I'm going to go pass it on the couch. Thanks for listening to The Close-Up. And we'll see you in about a month where we're going to talk about Sam Mendes.
Yes.
If that's how you say his name. All right. Yep. Thanks for listening, guys.
Adios.